It's Saturday night at the Redemptorist Monastery. Saturday night fever. Something inside of me, this like sounds like a pop song. Something inside of me doesn't want. I'm not going to go further on this. Something inside of me doesn't want to meditate. Something is resisting during meditation, but resistance is suppressed by the supply and peaceful feeling. But I can detect it again between meditations. Despite the peace and happiness, there is a subtle sensation like, I'd rather not, thanks. That's a really nice question, isn't it? So you've got some split personality there. Whatever it is. No, it's not. It's just, it's quite natural because there's always a bit of a problem in meditation, because what you're doing something really amazing. You're getting rid of yourself. There's something, I don't want to go. I don't want to disappear. I don't want to let go of all my suffering and all my burdens. Strange thing. Somebody once told me this story. I think it was like a Ram Dass story. Remember Ram Dass a long time ago, those of you old enough? This hippie guy. He was a friend of Timothy Leary, into big drugs big time. But anyway, he went off to India and became a guru. And when he came back, so he used to go to India for in those days. Anyway, one of his disciples asked him to visit her father, who was really sick in hospital. And her father was in constant pain. No medicine could fix what he was enduring, apparently. So he's really having a very, very hard time. And his daughter, you know, really respected this Ram Dass guru guy, said, why don't you come? Because, you know, you may be able to do some, you know, Hindu tikkari pokery, some razzmatazz, and, you know, maybe get rid of the pain. And so there he rolls in. Now, this guy, you know, in those days, you know, this really long hair, hippie beads, the whole works, you know, he looked really weird. And, you know, even for New York, you look weird. And so he got into the hospital. And his father took one look at him and said, get out. I don't want this sort of guy in my room. And so he wanted to throw him out. But his daughter said, look, you know, he's my guru. He's a wise guy. I don't care about that. And so that, you know, he would not listen to this guy at all. So his daughter was talking to him. And this guy, Ram Dass, decided just to give him a foot massage. He's massaging his feet there, and suddenly all the pain went away. And his father, this guy who'd been in constant pain for a long time, get out of here, leave my feet alone. He was actually rather have that sort of incredible pain than have sort of his whole world view sort of destroyed about, you know, how he looked at life and what was important to him. There's a fascinating story there. You can understand what's happening there. You know, we'd rather have our comfortable view of the way we look at life rather than get rid of the pain at that degree of sacrifice. So our views, that's very, very strongly held on to those views. We'd rather have not happiness and keep our views and get rid of the views and have peace and freedom. So this is what you're doing here. You're doing something which is very, very radical. You're changing the way you look at life. You're changing your idea of who you are, and this is what that resistance is. But don't worry about that, because just the bliss, the peace is just too good. You can't resist after a while. You can think you can actually fight that battle. I don't want to meditate. I don't want to get peace. I don't want to get enlightened. You know, just, you know, I want to enjoy my sex, my movies, my drink, whatever else you get into. But unfortunately, you just can't. It's too late now. I'm terribly sorry, everybody. But you've already been conditioned. You're past the point of no return. Now, once you get a taste of that peace and that bliss, it doesn't matter even if you have to disappear. That's just what it takes. That's fine. And this is a great part in this meditation, because here in this meditation, sometimes I think it's just samatha, peace, enjoying yourself. You never get any wisdom. Here you come across what we really mean by attachments. That's an attachment there. You want to go into peace, you know it's good, but you can't. That's what attachments are. Attachments that stop you enjoying yourself. They stop you being free. They're like balls and chains on your feet. And you can untie them at any moment, but you just don't want to. And every moment, every blockage in this meditation, you come across attachments at every stage. And to go deeper into more peace and more bliss, more profound and beautiful states of mind, just got to untie another attachment. This is where you find out what those attachments are. And those attachments get incredibly subtle when you really go deep inside. One of the attachments you have to give up is your attachment to your will, to your free choice, to your what you think is liberty, to do whatever you want, to choose whatever you want. On the other side, when the will stops, you realize that which you taught to be your absolute freedom, the freedom to do what you want, was not a freedom after all. It was completely conditioned. It was like this tyrant who was always telling you what to do. You're not deciding. The tyrant is. And to actually let go of that attachment to your will is huge, and that's really scary. To let go of your body is scary. You know you can let go of the body when the whole thing disappears. It happens in the meditation retreat, just sitting there enjoying your breath. Nah, I can't feel my hands. So what? What's the big deal? But many people, they're so attached to their hands, if you can't feel them, they get worried. And people get very worried sometimes. If just your hands disappear, what happens if your whole body disappears? I can't feel anything. Nah. It's great not to have hands. It's great not to have a body. But we're not used to that. That challenges our attachment to this thing which we think is ourselves. So this is where fear comes up. When there's a struggle there, it's great. It means the meditation's working. You're actually unlocking attachments. And you can't really stop. You got too far already. Resisting, what's resisting is your attachments. And you're doing something there because there's a little battle going on there. But there's no, the outcome is certain. You may be able to put off going deeper, but not for too long. That's why just before you get into jhanas, you see this beautiful jhana, but just right in front of you there, and just having a great time, just beautiful, but you don't want to go in because of fear. And the fear is that you realize you have to lose something to get into a jhana. All you have to lose is yourself. And suddenly, you know, I don't want to do that, I don't want to disappear. You know, and I'm the biggest fear of losing yourself. And then, oh, it's so nice, but I don't want to, but it's so nice, but I can't, it's so nice, but I can't, oh, what the hell, and you go for it. And that's what happens, you just get pulled in, because the bliss, the joy, is just too strong. And it just breaks the attachments. It is the bliss which breaks attachments. Just too much fun. You don't do it as an act of will, you just can't do that. These are very, very strong bonds of attachment, but the joy of the bliss is so strong. Oh, what the hell, let's go for it. Basically, that's what happens. So you just get pulled up. You're having a nice time already. You're enjoying the meditation, but sometimes you don't want to, but you can't. You have to. So, you know, might as well just forget about it and just meditate. Great question, though. I hope all of them are like this. I know more, should I wear shorts questions? I didn't see anyone in shorts yet. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, good evening. You did say samatha vipassana are both sides of the same coin. I have heard the word vipassana many times. You seldom mentioned it. May I suppose vipassana will naturally arise when we do mindfulness of the breath? It arises while you're doing the breath. And all, just that person there, they saw resistance there. That is getting insight into what's happening. Well, why is there the resistance? The more you hang out in those areas of resistance, the more you understand what's going on, you get insight. These are deep insights. The ones which really unlock the attachments, which throw away things. So as you're meditating this way, insights come naturally. You can't help but get these insights. One of the stories I say, a long time ago, Mr. Vipassana and Mrs. Samatha, they decided to go on a walk after dinner. They decided to go on top of a hill because Mr. Samatha wanted to go up there because it was very, very peaceful on top of the hill. But Mrs. Vipassana, she wanted to go up there for the beautiful view. So the two of them went together, Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana, hand in hand, Mr. Samatha went up there for the calm. Mrs. Vipassana went up there for the view. But when they reached the top of the hill, Mr. Samatha enjoys it so peaceful up there. But he also saw the view. And Mrs. Vipassana, she saw the view and she commented, oh, how peaceful it is up here. So Mr. Samatha also enjoyed the view. And Mrs. Vipassana enjoyed the calm. Because on top of the mountain or the hill, peace and the view coexist. They're together. So you may think you're doing Vipassana, you're going up there for the view, but you find the peace up there as well. You may think you're going up there for the peace, but you find the view up there as well, because they both coexist. Where there's stillness, there you see deeply. Where you see deeply, there you'll find stillness. The two are always together. You cannot separate them. So people who think you can, they're just missing the point. But Vipassana is not thinking. Thinking is like crazy people's stuff. Vipassana is seeing deeply. The old story about Vipassana, what can I be up? Okay. What is this? For the record here, I'm holding up. What am I holding up? What is it? Yeah, what else is it? Yeah, what else can you see? Yeah, anything else? Yeah, anything else? Yeah, keep looking. Anything else can you see? Yeah, anything else? Now, the object of this exercise, I've gone far enough now. When I first put this up, you say tissue box. And many of you thought that was it. You captured the whole essence of this thing. That's what thought does. It just gives it a name. And thinks, tissue box, done it, know it, finished. But I prompted you, what else is it? And then you saw different colours, squares, shape, whatever else. Now this is the problem with thinking. It's the first thought which comes along, we think we've known it, we've got it, this is what it is. When you're pushed, you see there's much more to it than that label. And the real way of insight, you look at this tissue box until you've exhausted all the labels. There's nothing more you can say about it. And then you can start seeing it. You start to see it beyond the labels. The labels are not the thing. They only describe the thing. They're inaccurate. But when actually you stop all the labelling, then you can start seeing things. To stop labelling, you need to be calm, still. You need to hold it in front of you for a long time. Then you start to see it. Peace, stillness, no thought, equals insight. You start to see things when you're still. When you're thinking, just all you see is labels. And that's all. So that's what Vipassana and insight is. We are mindful of breath, and when we calm down, we tend to observe rather than do. Great. Is it right to say, beside the breath which acts as the anchor, the mind naturally watches, but not intentionally, like thoughts, jealousy, etc., dissatisfaction? Okay, usually those are like movements of the mind, like themes of the mind which come up for a long time. And all those things, they're built up by your thoughts. So to be jealous, you know, you've got to look at the person sitting next to you and they just sit so straight for hours and hours and hours. And this is their first retreat. This is really unfair. Why do they get such good meditation? This is not fair. I've been coming to these places for a long time. I've given lots of donations. I give food to the monks every week. And this Jojo comes in from somewhere else and I've just overheard them. They say they get jhana. And I haven't. It's unfair. And that's jealousy. It all comes from thinking, thinking, thinking. Now, look. This is the trouble with thoughts. That we actually build up these emotions, which are completely inaccurate most of the time. There's this one monk, and I grew up with, he's a French monk, and he would just sit so ramrod straight, even first thing in the morning, you'd never see him nodding once. And I thought, wow, that guy's really got it. He must be in some deep jhanas. He must be, you know, that close to enlightenment. We all thought he was really getting there. And he was so quiet, would never speak to anybody. He was like this perfect monk. And then he disrobed. And I thought, my goodness, what's going on? And then, you know, it's a real shock because he thought, you know, of all the monks, if anyone's going to get enlightened, he would. And then when we asked him, why, what had happened? He said, all those mornings, which he was sitting ramrod straight. It was just so much effort. He was so pained inside. He was afraid. He was controlling his body just with such firmness. He said sometimes he would open his eyes and see monks like me nodding, falling asleep, and he was so jealous of me. If only I could let go that much and just allow myself to fall asleep, but he couldn't. And he was again a control freak, driven by fear. That's why he would not sort of relax and talk to others. And we all thought that that was almost enlightened. But he couldn't stand it. After 3 years of that, I felt, wow, how could you endure so much for 3 years of that tightness in your body and mind? And he couldn't afterwards, and he just had to let go and just disrobe. But it just showed me just how you can't tell what's going on. So it's a waste of time being jealous or trying to measure someone else. It's a waste of time measuring yourself. No, I don't know what I'm doing. So how can I measure what other people are doing? Just do it, that's all. So that way, you just, you know, it's a waste of time, jealousy, but this all comes from thinking. You build up your emotions. And if you're really smart at this, you can control other people's emotions. You can go, hey! See, it's easy to do. Now, why did you get afraid over there? Just I pressed the button and there it was. Now, you see that all of these stuff about your emotions. So, you're completely conditioned. Now, if you're really strong, you've got lots of mindfulness, you'd have just sound, that's all, and you wouldn't have got bothered. So, is it possible to gain insight? So, this is where the emotions are. So, after you really calm down, these emotions, or the negative ones, start to disappear. And you get the beautiful emotions. Emotions such as, the most beautiful emotion of all is the emotion of peace. And that's an emotion. It's just a colour of the mind which lasts for a long time. It's much better than jealousy or anger or greed or fear. It's amazing peace which lasts for a long time. Isn't that nice? You see, I'm controlling your emotions again. It's very easy to get your emotions going, but just like thoughts, like sounds, and it's sort of, this is where emotions come from. So when you stop all the naming, stop all the noting, the describing, all those negative emotions disappear. Instead you just get this incredible lovely peace, and it's just so nice. So that's the emotion to develop, the peace. Is it possible to gain insight before first jhana? For example, a beginner can also gain insight. The only way I can gain insight is deep insights, is ordinary insights. To get the really powerful insights, enlightenment insights, you do need to get the jhanas. But you can still get heaps and heaps of deep, wonderful insights beforehand. It's insights all the way. You know what the opposite of insight is? That's for excite. Insight and excite. So when you get excited, you're doing the complete opposite. So don't get excited. Get incited. Ajahn, regarding the beautiful breath, do you have to change your perception of the breath from boring to beautiful, or does it happen as a matter of course when you watch the breath until it is subtle? It happens as a matter of course. You don't do it. Stop driving the vehicle. Take your hands off the wheel. Stop interfering. Get out of the way. Butt out. As they say. In other words, butt out of your meditation. Just leave it alone and it happens. So you're just watching the breath. That's all you need to do. This is good enough. Be content where you are. You don't want anything else. This is enough. Because you're not doing anything, it calms down. And this is a basic teaching in meditation. The more still you are, the more energy goes into your mind. The more energy which goes into the mind, whatever you look at becomes brighter and more beautiful. It's not the breath which is beautiful. It's just your mind is opened, energized. And whatever you see becomes beautiful. Even if you see just like a lump of dropping from a bird, you think, wow, that's just so wonderful. The different colors of white and this grays inside of that, and just the way it just is all shiny when it's just dropped. Wow, that's just exquisite. And all it is it's just bird shit, but your mind is just opened out so much that whatever you look at, it's actually beautiful. And this is the nature of it. It happens, and you'll be surprised at what you see is this beautiful, which is normally not beautiful at all. It's not that you're looking at the birdseed and say, when should I go to the stage of the beautiful birdseed? You can't play around with that. It just happens naturally. And this is just what when the mind starts to get bright. That's all that happens. So you don't change perceptions. You just be still. And the perceptions change themselves. However, there's a little bit of a thing you do. Just whatever you do, develop the perception of the beautiful. Just stop this fault-finding mind. And when you do the perception of the beautiful, then it's much easier to see the beauty in the breath. Is that okay? Anyone want to comment on that? Just a pause. Okay. Last night you said that effort creates friction in the mind and unsettles it. How does this then reconcile with a right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path, where conscious effort is needed to abandon and guard against unwholesome states and develop and maintain wholesome ones? Is some effort needed to get rid of all effort, like some desire needed to get rid of all desire? Is right effort conventional reality and no effort ultimate reality? Okay. The way the Buddha taught right effort is a fascinating part of the Eightfold Path. It says, whatever it needed to do to abandon unwholesome states, to keep out any unwholesome states, to arouse good states and maintain good states, the four right efforts. But the point is that whatever you do, or whatever is necessary, it is the end is the most important. Now, what is like these wholesome states like peace? Get rid of this restlessness or this desire, this ill will. And through your experience, you find that all types of striving, they always give rise to unwholesome states in the long run. Craving is the cause of suffering, said the Buddha. Noble truth number two. And the end of suffering is through letting go, renouncing. So your efforts actually becomes a way of guarding the mind so you don't interfere. It's an effort to be still, an effort to stop doing things, an effort just to leave things go alone. The effort of loving kindness, the effort to say the door of my heart is open to all things which are arising in this moment. It's a no effort. You're not choosing, you're not rejecting, you're not holding, you're not doing anything. So it is an undoing. You're undoing yourself. You are undone when you become enlightened. And it's that idea, unentangled, ungrasped, is what one is doing. So that right effort is a fascinating part of the Eightfold Path. It's not struggling or striving. It's mindfulness, being still, waiting, that type of effort and doing. And you know that from your own experience. Have the insight, whenever you struggle, what happens? Whenever you strive, what I said this morning, it's a very deep and powerful insight. All striving eventually leads to frustration, whether sooner or later you get frustrated. As, what was it, Oscar Wilde said, there's only two tragedies in life. The first is not getting what you want. And the second is getting what you want. And after a while you get frustrated. And all of you, you know, you find the perfect partner. At last I found him or her. You get frustrated after a while because it's not really perfect after all. It's just an illusion. So you think somewhere else out there is a perfect partner. The one meant for me. My soulmate, the person who's just waiting for me and I'm waiting for them. Get real. That never happens. There's just too many movies, that's all. But that's what people like to think. That's what they like to think. So actually, the real effort is just let go, leave things alone. To stop rather than keep starting. And that's such a powerful teaching. Because, you know, once you can understand that, meditation is so easy, but, you know, when you stop putting effort in, a lot of things disappear. You get a lot of happiness, but you disappear. Because you are the one who makes the effort. And when you don't have to do anything anymore, what's the purpose of you being? It's the same with the idea of a God. A God has to do something to be. God never did anything. He just pressed a button and started the universe, but never got involved. It doesn't exist. You know, a thing exists if it does something. You know, is this box, is this alive? You poke it and see if it sort of cries, leave me alone. If it doesn't do anything, then it's dead. It's the same as, you know, you see someone in the morning, you poke them and kick them, see if they're alive or they're dead. And if they say, leave me alone, oh, you are alive. Okay, fair enough. Isn't that how we find out if someone was dead? So if a God doesn't do anything, he's dead. Yeah? Yeah. No, if you remember there's an indoor and an outdoor. Don't just open the indoor, open the outdoor as well. So anyway, it goes here, but of course I go out again. So the door of my heart, the indoor and the exit door, they're both open, okay? Don't stay too long. So what it is actually, this is, when the door of the heart's open to the moment, you're not doing anything. This is why metta meditation is a powerful way into jhanas. This moment is good enough, and it's the object is not important. It's where it's where you're coming from. That's what's important. That's why if you just make the mind so peaceful, whatever's happening inside the mind, you just allow it to be. Everything disappears. This emptiness comes out of metta. That's why, you know, from love, you get zero. Like in tennis, love all, zero. Nothing's happening. Everything disappears. Gone. That's it. I know that's bad English, because love actually comes from l'œuf, the French, meaning the egg, because now l'œuf looks like egg. But anyway, this is what happens when you sort of do love and kindness meditation. Things disappear. So you open the door of your heart, but things come in, they also go out as well. You've got an open door, and things just fall away. That's what, you know, I always say that joke about if you keep an open mind, your brain will fall out. Which is a great thing to do. I had to fall out. The brain is just too much bother. Okay, does that sort of answer your question, sort of, or not really? Okay, think about it. Ajahn, could you please clarify this morning your explanation of anapanasati meditation? Do you observe in and out breath or watch your in breath and out breath as an outsider? Do you observe count in and out breath? Okay. You just leave it alone. Just like the breath is somebody else's breath. You're breathing in, breathing out. In other words, it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the body. It's the nature, so you can't control it. That's why I said look upon it like the waves of an ocean coming in and going out. The waves don't belong to you, they belong to the nature of the ocean. You can't make them come in faster or slower, bigger or smaller. So the breath just comes in and goes out. It's not mine, it just brings air into my body, it takes it out again. Nothing to do with me, not my business, just watch it. It's easy to do. And if you don't know how to do it, then do the little exercise, close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, at the end of the 3rd breath, open your eyes. You can do that. How did you do that? However it was you did that, that's how you watch the breath in breath meditation. That which tells you what the breath is doing. You don't need to count the breath. If you want to count the breath, that's just a little bit extra, just to help. But it's not absolutely necessary. You observe. At first, when you haven't done breath meditation before, it's a bit weird. What are you supposed to watch? And sometimes that's why sometimes people watch the tip of their nose. But that's doing nose meditation. Sometimes you watch your belly, and we call that belly meditation. And that's not watching the breath. Watch the breath. That which tells you what the breath is doing. When you first start this again, you can't recognize what we're talking about. After a while, you recognize, oh, this is what I'm supposed to watch. You get recognition. After recognition, you get familiarity. You know the breath. I've been doing this for such a long time, it's very easy to know what the breath is. Sometimes it's hard to describe it to other people. You know it so well yourself. I'm familiar with it, and it's such an old friend. I'm just so comfortable hanging out with my breath. So So it's an old mate of mine, me and the breath. We've had some really great times together in the past. So that when I was in my breath, hi guy, how you doing? Let's hang out together. So it's easy to do. That's what you do with the breath meditation. Is that quite clear? Any question? Go. I wanted to question devotion as it was left last night. Isn't devotion an act of the heart? Not really, because I think devotion is more like an act of attachment. Because sometimes people are so devoted that they're attached. And that's why, I mean, there was one guy in the time of the Buddha, one monk called Vimalakirti. And he was so devoted to the Buddha that he would never leave the Buddha alone. And the Buddha said, get out of here, go, get away. He said, no, I get so sad if I wasn't with you. No, why don't you be with me? And this is actually where the Buddha gave that famous saying, he who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. He said that to Wakali. So, you know, you're just attached to this form, the container. You know, so don't be devoted to the person. To be devoted to the truth, be devoted to the Dhamma. So that way, you're not devoted to Ajahn Brahma, Ajahn Wayama, or someone else. You're devoted to the Dhamma, the truth, not the person. Otherwise, when Ajahn Brahma snuffs it, gone. Oh, I lost the teacher. Oh. And that's that stupidity, that's attachment. But do be devoted to the Dhamma. The Dhamma's always there for you. But be devoted to the right thing. Not attachment, but be devoted to letting go. Be devoted to abandoning things. Be devoted to freedom, simplicity, peace, happiness, liberty. Now you know what we should really be devoted to. So devotion is often attachment, and often we're devoted to the wrong things. How many people are devoted to a soccer team or a footy team? How many people are devoted to their favourite music? Or, you know, to Jimi Hendrix, or I don't know who. This is a long time ago, he's dead now. I don't know what you're devoted to, but you can see it's like attachment. Where there's attachment, there's going to be pain and suffering. Maybe devoted to your husband or to your kids, and how much suffering is that? So instead of being devoted to containers, be devoted to the contents. And we'll put another saying, the Buddha is a container, a monk or a nun, a teacher is just a container, a Buddhist society, a temple is a container, a book is only a container. So what's inside is important. When you see the Dhamma inside, the truth, the freedom, that's what's important. That's what you should worship. So that quite clear. An act of the heart, yeah, but go not to the person or the container. Go to the contents. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, apart from concentration, does energetic effort and equanimity play a part in this retreat? Thank you. It's all the same. Concentration, this is samadhi. That was the first translation of samadhi, like concentration, but the trouble is that concentration is just so forceful, and also that sometimes people have said that, my goodness, if this is concentration we're doing here and this is a meditation camp, then this must be a concentration camp. And some meditation retreats, it feels like that. Get you out of bed in the morning. If anyone doesn't get out of bed in the morning at 4 o'clock, you get straight to the punishment room. That's not what we do here. Apart from concentration. So instead of concentration, I've used these other words. For a long time, I said concentration doesn't really fit what we're doing in meditation. And sometimes I call it sustained attention. But more recently, I've called it like attentive stillness. So we call it attentive stillness. And that is a much more evocative and positive way of describing samadhi. Attentive stillness. Got it? And that means it's relaxed, it's not forceful. And it just describes the state. That's what we're doing here. And to do, be able to have that, the effort has to be letting go. And stillness gives rise to the equanimity. It's a sign of equanimity. You're absolutely still. So it's all the same thing. We're not doing one and not the others. All three, the whole Eightfold Path, coming together. That's why this is also Satipatthana. You're investigating through experience, not through thought, not through effort. You're just amassing the data of deep meditative experiences until you get so much data, so much new information, you can't resist the insights which they're telling you, and then you become enlightened. So we're already doing all of those three things and much more. Is that quite clear? Next question. This is in Thai. I better look at this later on and I'll answer it afterwards. It'll take me about 5 minutes to read that. Another one as well. Okay, you Thai people here. Can you please translate these ones before you write them out? It takes too much time. Life after death question. I once heard on TV when a journalist interviewed a ghost. No. Hey, certainly. I once heard on TV when a journalist interviewed the late Kerry Packer. The late Kerry Packer. This is a really interesting question. And he asked, oh no, this is the late Kerry Packer died. This must have been before he died. Oh, what a shame. That was a really interesting question there. So the TV interview Kerry Packer, he asked, is there life after death? What do you want to ask Kerry Packer for? What does he know? To which Kerry's reply was, the good news is there is no hell and the bad news is there is no heaven. And this is why you never trust journalists, or especially Kerry Packer. Apparently he suffered a heart attack and was clinically dead for a few minutes until paramedics revived him. And he thinks that one tiny little experience like that qualifies him to be the expert upon life and after death. Ridiculous, isn't it? The arrogance of some people who think that, you know, once they've had one experience, they know everything about everything. So it's really stupid. Anyway, how does the teaching of Buddhism account for that? What is your response? Okay, he was only dead for a few seconds. He probably never had time for you to float out of his body and see what's happening, or he probably forgot about it. I'm not sure. He probably wasn't actually fully dead, because out of body experiences only happen when people are under cardiac arrest and also brain dead. The brain stopped functioning, and then you float out of your body. So he probably didn't get it, that's all. But the next time, when he died properly, I bet he's really ruining what he said there. And if he was still alive again, he'd probably sue that journalist. Dear Ajahn, if there is no one there, who is doing the striving and attaining the jhanas? It is, you're just disappearing. There is still something left to attain the jhanas. But the more you let go, the more that it disappears. And to actually to get into Nibbana is the biggest question. Who gets into Nibbana? No one. You just disappear before you enter. And that's, you disappear on the doorway and you're gone. Isn't that wonderful? Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. But what are you actually saying? Who is doing the striving, doing the attaining? Stupidity is doing the striving. And if you're striving, you identify with being stupid. So that's what's doing the striving, the stupid person inside of you. But that's not really you, never mind. And once you attain the jhana, how easy is it to get into it again? It's easier once you've got one jhana. In other words, the mind knows what's going on, it knows what these things are. And also it knows how just delightful these are. That was sweet. I know that sometimes that people go to places like Penang to get the durian, and once they've tasted it once, they've got to go back there again. Now that's just durian. Imagine what it's like with jhana. Now this is really sweet stuff. and you've tasted it once, wow, you've got to get it again. And this is actually fascinating, because it's why many people become monks or nuns, or why they really get into meditation. They've had a taste of something which is just so delicious, they will never forget it for the rest of their life. And they have to find some way of, you know, getting some deep meditation to re-experience, because it's the most meaningful, real experience you've ever had. Compared to those jhanas, everything else is just a waste of time. So, once you've tasted these things, you've got to get back there again. And the reason I teach like this is many people have had those experiences. Sometimes they just fluke them, sometimes it's just a bit of luck when they're young. And you always teach people, don't look at the result, look at the causes. And recreate the causes which gave rise to that deep meditation. Don't just look at the result. The simile is just this person who is going to the kitchen and thinking, like, just after lunch, and you're on the kitchen duty, and you think, oh, when are all these dishes and pans going to be washed? I don't want to have to do this. I want to go and have a rest or meditate some more. When are these dishes going to be washed? If you think like that, the dishes never get washed. You're thinking of the goal. Instead, you think, dishes need to be washed. How do dishes become washed? You put them in the hot water, you put a bit of soap powder in there, and you rub them, and then you rinse them, and you dry them. And that's how it's done. So you recreate the causes. And after a very short while, all the dishes are done, sparkling and radiant in the shelf. That's how you recreate the clean dishes. And so, some person's got a jhana once, and they come to a retreat and think, oh, there's so much to do, so many meditations, when is my mind going to get into jhana again? I don't want to have to work so hard meditating, I just want to get into jhana. And that way you never get into jhana. Well, the wise meditator thinks, how did I get into jhana last time? What did I do? Sat down, let go, relax, no effort. Be patient, see what happens. Just like putting the dishes into the water and washing them. And then after a while you recreate the causes. And because you recreate the causes, after a while there you are, your mind is sparkling and radiant in jhanas, just like the clean dishes. So never look at the result. Always look at the causes. And your effort is to recreate the causes. And those causes are no effort. Relax, let go, be still. So that's what we do. So once you've achieved the jhana, if you've got some decent instructions, and I always say, don't think of the jhana. What caused it? Where did that come from? Why? How did it happen? Remember that and learn from that. That is called insight. Once the message gets home, you know it's real insight if you know exactly what the causes are. You put them into place and the same effect happens. So we'll have how it works. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahm, can one forget the details of one's past when they are in the present moment all the time? As those details are not reinforced by being into consciousness, can you please explain? You always forget the details of your past, even in the present moment. For example, what did you have for lunch today? Can you remember it completely? You do that because you enjoyed it, because you paid attention to what you enjoy. Now, let's ask something else. What time did you get up this morning? What did you do when you first woke up? Complain. That's the other thing. Negativity. We always remember negative things as well. We pay attention to those things. But when you remember these things, sometimes we only remember what's important to us, and we usually change our memory to suit what we want to think. That's why sometimes people look at the last retreat they went on. And let's change that. Whenever I give a talk on a Friday night, sometimes afterwards people say, that was a really nice talk you gave last night. And I would say, yeah, what did I talk about then? Well, I don't know, but it was a nice talk. And all I remember is the jokes. I remember the football joke which I gave last Friday. That's the only thing they really remember about the talk. What else it was, all those sort of, but they don't really remember. Because what you really enjoy, or what you really don't enjoy, which is painful, that's what you really remember. So the point is here that sort of the past is so uncertain, we don't really know what happened, we think we do, you're actually always forgetting the details. You're not just forgetting the details, a lot of the time you add more details. Recreating, not what actually happened, but what you expect should have happened. You add details which weren't really there. And you believe in the past afterwards. You believe in your perceptions, which are not real. And every psychologist knows just how we add and subtract from our past memories. We create new ones, which aren't real. They have very little relation to the past. And there was this psychologist, I've got the article somewhere in my room, and he was just about to retire. He was, I think, working in Montreal. And he was cleaning out some papers from his office, and he came across these series of questionnaires which he'd given in a school in the United States about 30 years previously, asking kids about what their home life was, what they were afraid of, what they liked. And really straightforward questions like, and one I remembered was, at home, does your parents discipline you with, say, corporal punishment or not? Do they spank you? And he found that school, he traced some of those kids, and he gave the children exactly the same questionnaire, and now they were 30 years older, just to see if the experience at that time was the same as their memory of that experience. So little questions like, you know, did your parents spank you when you were kids? He thought, they said yes they did. 30 years later they said no they didn't. Their memories had completely changed. And they changed so much that the psychologists had very strong information to how uncertain your memories of the past are. You really think that happened, but it didn't. You said at the time it didn't. But for you, you are absolutely sure, yes, my parents did spank me. And the parents say, no, we never did. I say, yes, you did. No, we didn't. You change your memory. You are literally creating your past. You're not remembering it. You're creating a past to suit you. When you see how that happens, it's just how you just cannot trust what really happened. And sometimes it's quite astounding when you get actually evidence, like an old photograph or like a book or some yearbook or something. And you find that what you remembered actually never happened. Your memory of the past was not true. But you believed it. When one memory is proven to be so inaccurate and false, all of your memory becomes subject to doubt. So much so, I don't know that where you were brought up, what you did, what happened to you, you think that's real. Half of it is probably fake. And you can't tell the difference between the fake memories and the real ones. That's why you can't trust the past. Let it go. Start the future. We all know the future is uncertain, but the past is also completely uncertain. We make it up as we go along. Dear Ajahn, can one attain jhana by doing walking meditation? If so, what is the equivalent to the beautiful breath stage? Okay, the equivalent to the beautiful breath stage is the beautiful walking stage. That's not a joke, because this is what happens. You just, when you do walking meditation, maybe I'll say some more about it tomorrow, I don't know, a few days, I'll tell you some more. You, first of all, present moment awareness. So you're just in the moment, you're not thinking about the future or the past, you're not worrying where you're going or where you came from, just where you are right now. Present moment awareness. Number two, silence. Stop thinking, having a commentary about what's going on. When you're present moment, silence, only then you're in the moment. Only then you're silent. Only then are you mindful. And then once you've got that basic mindfulness, you just watch the feet move. Left foot, right foot, just as you watch in-breath, out-breath. Then you go to the full awareness of the moving of the feet from the beginning of the the left foot moving, to the end of the left foot moving, the beginning of the right foot moving, to the end of the right foot moving, seeing the pauses between the movements of the feet, just the same way you see the beginning of an in-breath, the end of an in-breath, beginning of the out-breath, the end of the out-breath, even seeing the pauses between the breaths. So I said that the breath is just the movement of the feet now. And then after a while, the breath becomes very beautiful. After a while, the movement of the feet becomes just so delicious, so absorbing. Just having a wonderful, peaceful, happy time watching the beautiful walking. And that's the stage. Usually you can't get any further than that. I never thought it was possible to get into a jhana while you were walking. However, Ajahn Yanadhammo tells me there is one monk, a famous monk in Thailand, who can get into jhana doing walking meditation. Only it's not advisable. Because once you get into jhana, you lose all contact with your five senses, and this monk keeps on walking into trees. He's having a wonderful time. It's just his mindfulness is inside, all these bumps and scratches on his face. So the story of Ajahn Yanadhammo, I don't know if it's true or not, because Ajahn Yanadhammo does spin some tall yarns, but nevertheless, they're great yarns, and who cares? They deserve to be true. But anyhow, he says that this monk gets in jhana while you're walking meditation. So it's unadvisable. Don't do it. If you start getting really peaceful, just sit down and get into jhana while you're sitting. Two, I've heard that samadhi attained by walking is much stronger and lasts longer. Is it correct? No, it's not correct, because you get much deeper meditation through the sitting. However, it has benefits when you do walking meditation, because you're actually doing something. It's good for your body, so you feel healthier. And also because you're doing when you're walking, you can actually take that samadhi, sit down, and then it can give you deeper samadhi. It's a support for the sitting meditation. The sitting meditation is a support for the walking meditation. But of the two, you have to say that sitting meditation is the best. The Buddha got enlightened sitting down. So try the sitting meditation. It's number one. Yes. I just one step at a time speed. So it's the first gear, the gear of now. So it doesn't matter, fast or slow. You don't time yourself. You don't know how fast or how slow you're going. Say when you're breathing, you don't know how fast or how slow the breath is going, and when you go to the full awareness of the breath. Just one moment is all you know. So basically, keep it natural. This is not like a Commonwealth Games, walking sort of competition. Nor is it to see who can walk the slowest. I see this in Vipassana retreats. It's a competition of who can go slowest. And they're sort of walking, because they walk together in a room, and they time each other to see who's the slowest walker. And they say, I was much slower than you. You got to the wall before me. That's really stupid. So we don't do things like that. We don't compare ourselves with other people. We don't even measure ourselves against the clock. Just do it natural and see what happens. Okay. Okay, that's next last question. I'm not doing tight ones. Dear Ajahn, fear is a big obstacle in my mind. What is behind fear, and how does one overcome it? Thank you. People are fear of a lot of things, like ghosts. Maybe because there's a ghost in this retreat center. Da 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 da. Are you afraid? It's true that ghosts like to come to these places where there's religious people. They're just coming here for merit, that's all. Are you afraid? No, you should not be afraid of ghosts, because you are much stronger than ghosts. If a ghost comes into your room, you say, get out of here! And if they won't go, so I'm going to go and tell Ajahn Brahm. Go, please don't tell Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell Ajahn Brahm. And then I go. Because ghosts are much more afraid of monks than, you know, the people are of them. So, but that's just one type of fear. The real fear you have is of losing something you're attached to. Fear is always a fear of losing something you think is precious. Something is about to be taken away, and you think this is important to you. So one of the wonderful ways of overcoming fear is just seeing you don't have anything anyway. What you could be afraid of? You've got nothing to lose, literally. And that way, that's why, you know, in our Western world, the most fearful thing you could have is like the devil coming to take over your soul. In these movies, you have these movies that people sell their soul to the devil. It's all Christian stuff. And I'm still waiting after all these years for the devil to come along and do me a deal for my soul. How about, you know, we're building a meditation retreat center. How about $100,000 for my soul? Done? I'll take it. I'll take the 100,000 and give it to the Buddhist meditation center. Because I know, actually, I'll be fraud, wouldn't I? I wouldn't be able to do it. Because I know that I've got no soul. There's nothing in there anyway. It's just no self. So, you know, what have I got to lose? Nothing. You can tell whatever you want. Nothing belongs to me anyway. When you understand you've got nothing to lose, what can you be afraid of? Nothing there. What can you take? Just an illusion. So when you haven't got anything, then you're not afraid of losing things. You've got nothing to lose. So all fear is a sign of attachment. Attachment is a sign of ownership. And it's a delusion to think you own anything. You don't. You don't own anything at all. You don't own your car. You don't own your house. You don't own your physical material possessions. If you did, you would be able to take them with you, but you can't. You don't own your body, otherwise you'd be able to tell your body, don't hurt. You don't own your mind. If you own the mind, you'd be able to tell, okay, mind, get into jhanas. Come on, shut up, stop talking. Shut up, be quiet, be still, meditate. Can you tell your mind to do that? I can't tell my mind to do that. If I tell it, it just rebels. If I tell it to do anything, it becomes like the donkey. No, I won't, it says. Okay, fair enough. So I don't tell it anything. And it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything, then it gets into jhanas. So this is how you work with this mind of yours. You've got nothing to be afraid of. However, in your meditation, you will come across fear at every stage of this meditation retreat. And that's a sign you're getting somewhere. So when fear comes up, well done. You've got something to work on here. What are you afraid of losing? If you ask that question, say, oh, this doesn't belong to me anyway. What's the big deal? I'm afraid of, you know, not waking up in time in the morning for breakfast. Is that what you're afraid of? Doesn't matter. There's always lunch coming afterwards. If you're still asleep at lunchtime, doesn't matter, there's always breakfast the next morning. And anyway, you can probably sneak out to the deli around the corner, no one will notice you've gone. Those with mobile phones can probably get a takeaway pizza. I've seen them arriving and just passing the pizza through the window at night time. I don't know what you get up to. What are you afraid of anyway? Just nothing worthwhile being afraid of. It's great when you have no fear. And the ghost comes up to you, go, ooh. Say, hi, ghost. And you're afraid. And ghosts get really pissed off when you're not afraid of them. They go and haunt somebody else. Because you're no fun anymore. So that way you've got nothing to lose. So don't be afraid. When fear comes up, ask, what am I afraid of losing? See that, it's an attachment. Untie it and you've got no fear anymore. Are you afraid of dying? You're going to die sometime. Might as well get over and done with. Isn't it better to die when you're young? If you don't die when you're young, what's going to happen to you? You're going to go to these old people's homes. Have you gone to these old people's homes? When you get really old and sick and nobody looks after you. Is that why you want to die? So why do you want to die? Why are you afraid of dying now? What could be a better place to die than on a meditation retreat? In jhana. Wow, this is great. Yeah, I'm here. I'll give you a cheap funeral, special discount because you died on my meditation retreat. So why are you afraid of dying? You shouldn't be afraid of dying. That's one of the biggest fears, because you're attached to your body. Why are you afraid of other people dying? They're going to die eventually anyway. The more they go, the more free you are. Unless you have to worry about other people. Don't be afraid. Like, sometimes you're afraid of stuffing up and making a fool of yourself. It's wonderful when you make a fool of yourself. It makes other people laugh. Give them a good time. If you do something really, really stupid, you're a very compassionate, kind person. You make other people laugh. So don't be afraid of making big mistakes. So that way, there's nothing to be afraid of. You can just enjoy yourself, and who cares? Okay, that's the thing. I'm getting tired now. It's gone past 9 o'clock. So, any other comments or questions? Yeah, okay. I was afraid you can ask that. Yeah, go on.
Oh. Just to tell yourself, then when you meditate, then you abandon things, then when you for example become enlightened, that thing that becomes you are talking about anatta. And I thought that was just a preparation state to just a thing that samadhi just being the impermanent.
Oh yeah, but the one you just have. That path that becomes just a very stable, just a way of looking at life. So the right view becomes natural. It doesn't come from you, it's just there. So it becomes like an essential part of the Eightfold Path. It's just the thoughts are always that way. You don't abandon right thought once you've finished with it. It's just always there. You just have to, you can't do anything else. Until the time of Nibbana, when everything disappears, only then does the past disappear. I think you're referring to the simile of the raft, where the Buddha said the Eightfold Path is like a raft to take you across a body of water from a place of danger to a place of safety. And he said, when you get over the other side, do you actually carry the raft on the back of your back and carry it around? Of course you don't. You leave it there because it's done its job. But the problem is, people say, oh, you say you don't have to be attached to the Eightfold Path, the Buddha said. You only throw it away when you've got to the other side. You don't throw away the raft in the middle of the stream. Or even worse, when you haven't even embarked from this bank here. That's what most people do. They see the Eightfold Path and they abandon it before they've even paddled off even an inch half away from the shore. So they never get anywhere. And when they really understand the Eightfold Path, it's just what happens when you disappear. It's the nature just to have a perfect view and have no effort. Samadhi becomes easy. Mindfulness just becomes the ground state. So you don't do it. It just is there when you disappear. That's why that saying, the first part of this retreat, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. I'll turn that around. When no traveller is seen, there you see the path. So the Eightfold Path is what comes into being when you disappear. It's a nice way of looking at it. So you don't abandon the Eightfold Path, you abandon yourself. And then the Eightfold Path is what's there. Yeah. Correct, yeah. So the right view just grows and grows and grows, just like samadhi grows and grows, like mindfulness grows and grows. One of the teachings which you don't hear very often is the different intensities of mindfulness. And mindfulness is not just being mindful, it's huge differences between ordinary mindfulness and power mindfulness and super power mindfulness and super duper power mindfulness. And all these you actually experience when you're meditating, you really are incredibly powerfully mindful sometimes. And you can know the difference in intensity. So just as you've got different intensities or different depths of right view, you have different depths of all these other factors as well. And it's great when they come to intensity, like perfect view. You can see just so clearly. Yeah, so you start off and then you sort of don't think about it too much, and you let it all go, and then the mind becomes peaceful, you see more, the right view grows, not through thinking, not through reading, not through listening, it goes to the experience of deep states of stillness. That's why the famous teaching of the Buddha, It is from attentive stillness, samadhi, that you see things as they truly are. Yata bhuta jnana dasana, samadhi pachaya, yata bhuta jnana dasana. See things as they truly are as a result of samadhi. Not a result of thinking, not as a result of listening, as a result of samadhi. That's why all you've read, all you've heard, push it all aside, get an attentive stillness, and then you'll understand what the Dhamma is. In the deep stages of meditation. Yeah. So let's go for it. The night is still young. People are only just starting to party. Just, you know, in Northbridge, which is the red light district, just a short while from here. If they're partying, why can't we party here? Tonight, the jhana party. And everyone is invited. So let's party. Have deep some meditation. Those of you who don't want to party, well, wow, they call it wowsers in Australia. You just want to go to bed. You just go to bed. Enjoy yourself. I'll see you in the morning. I'm sure you'll be there for breakfast. Maybe not in the morning chanting, but certainly for breakfast. So see you in the morning. Have a nice evening. If you are a bit tired, go to bed. It's only the second day. Some of you still got sleep deficit. Take it easy. You know, don't go through willpower. Go through nature. When you feel like you really want to stay up and meditate, go for it. If you don't. Be kind. You've got nothing to prove. Don't try and beat your record. Just learn how to give up. Be still. And allow your ego to completely disappear. So see you later.